From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we learn about some of the misinformation surrounding Wisconsin's election recount. Then, our Fit for You segment speaks with a cancer survivor who biked across America to raise awareness and prove something to herself.
I want people to know that cancer is survivable. There is no fault in anybody who doesn't survive, but I wanted people to see living evidence that you can get through this and have a robust life on the other side.
Plus, astronomy contributor Jean Creighton joins us to talk about the privatization of space travel.
People imagine that this is a brand new thing and maybe a departure from what NASA used to do. But the Apollo missions required NASA to subcontract with 20,000 companies.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The election recount is continuing in Milwaukee and Dane counties, where officials say uninformed observers are obstructing the process. It's also slow-moving because President Trump's attorneys have been interrupting the process and making unsubstantiated claims of fraud. Some Trump campaign observers have been objecting to every ballot that officials try to count. Others have been breaking rules and causing disruptions. In part, these issues may stem from a bigger problem facing the recount process: rampant misinformation that isn't supported by facts. Reporter Eric Litke keeps track of these claims for PolitiFact Wisconsin, and he joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about the misinformation plaguing this process.
Since the election ostensibly ended, there's been a lot of misinformation that's floating around. How would you characterize the landscape of misinformation right now as it relates to this election?
Yeah, in the few years that I've been doing fact-checking consistently, it's certainly unprecedented in terms of the volume of both claims and then just the volume of stuff with absolutely no basis in fact. We'll certainly find exaggerations and misunderstandings commonly across the political landscape, but there's just such a large number of claims that really just don't seem to care much what their foundation is in reality. It's just all about whether it makes the point they're trying to make, whether it reaches the audience that they feel this is going to resonate with.
It is interesting, of course, as a journalist, looking at a lot of these different lies, pieces of misinformation that really don't have any basis in reality. As you've been going through the different lies and claims, what have been some of the most persistent things that you've heard since the election took place?
The biggest stuff all really ties down to how votes were reported. We have this tendency to see the vote returns on election night as this kind of a horse race or something, but in reality, those votes all exist. It's just a matter of which pile we get to first. And we saw leading up to the election, we knew that this was going to be a long delay, in particular counting absentee ballots, and in particular in big cities like Milwaukee. And so we knew that those were groups that were going to skew heavily Democratic, and they did. But instead of saying, sure, this was something we saw coming, it's just saying, you know, what we see are claims that assert that there's something nefarious there, that somehow this proves voter fraud to some degree. So that kind of misunderstanding simply of the voting and vote counting process is really the most persistent thing. It's repackaged and represented in different ways, but that's kind of the core problem.
As you say, it's been repackaged, re-presented. There's a variety of different numbers that seem to get pulled into that. But that's a big one. And this one, the claim I'm about to bring up, plays into that whole thing. The idea that the Milwaukee elections chief lost an elections flash drive at the same time that more votes were tabulated for Biden. Can you unpack that a bit? I'm not even sure that I know what an elections flash drive would actually mean.
Yeah, so there's a lot going on here. This was circulated on a number of kind of right-leaning news and commentary websites, some of whom played it fairly straight, some of whom really went overboard with it. The one that we're looking at specifically is from the Gateway Pundit, which has been a regular fountain of misinformation in the wake of the election. And they're tying this flash drive to this vote jump that I'd referenced. And we did see a big swing to the left in the Wisconsin vote. But again, this was the city of Milwaukee counting its absentee ballots. Those were all counted in one central location, and there was no reporting done until the whole pile was done. So essentially, we got 170,000 absentee ballots that all came in at once. And as expected, the vast majority of those went to Biden. So we did see this big increase. So we've written a number of fact checks explaining why that was expected and legitimate. But here we see it resurfacing in the context of this lost flash drive. So the flash drive we're talking about is what was used by elections officials to get votes from a tabulator over to the final place where they are reporting them. So there's the tabulator is the physical machine that ballots are fed into, and it generates the count. Now the tabulators used by the city of Milwaukee here are not connected to the internet. So the way to get that data off is you simply plug in a flash drive, it uploads the file, and they carry it off. So the city of Milwaukee had 12 flash drives, and the head of the elections commission took those drives, took them to the reporting facility, realized once she got there, she only had 11. So she called back and had a police officer sent over with this 12th drive. It's important to note that this is a 15-minute window, right? It wasn't lost for hours. During the time that it was not in the right place, it was in an area that is limited and controlled by elections officials. Okay, this was not open to the public. It's also a place where we know what was on the drive, right? So we can look at the timestamp of when these totals were uploaded to the drive and the timestamp that they checked later on, so they can basically confirm this drive was not tampered with in the interim. So there is this brief delay in getting this where it was supposed to be, but we can confirm nothing was changed. The votes were recorded and reported properly, but that's, of course, not how it's presented.
It does sound like, you know, a situation that I think we've all had where you walk out of the office, you've left a file on your desk, you know, 10 minutes later realize you don't have the file, you walk back in and there it is. And because this is an election, as you say, it seems like that area, any area that you'd be holding a drive with that kind of information would be pretty well protected.
Certainly. And in fact, even the live stream was continuing to run. This entire process was being live streamed. But it's just this understanding that there's going to be human error in any kind of mechanism, especially something on the scope of an election. But that's why we have these redundancies. We have a process like the canvas that goes back and compares vote totals to make sure that the numbers we got make sense. So there's going to be mistakes that occur, and they're going to be caught because that's how the system is set up.
There have been a lot of different lies and pieces of misinformation that play on this kind of ignorance of how the process is supposed to go down, essentially. And we're seeing a lot of that resurface in the recount effort. Can you describe some of the things that you've heard that are just plain wrong as it relates to the recount?
So we're seeing all manner of objections. The Journal Sentinel had reported there's one observer, for example, that was just going from table to table objecting to literally every ballot that was cast. But I mean, there's objections based on the color of the ink that was used. There's one that has been brought up repeatedly looking at these voters who listed themselves as indefinitely confined and attempts to throw that entire stack of ballots out, which is a significant number when you're looking statewide. So it's basically anything that's not a traditional vote cast at a polling place, someone is ginning up a reason to say this is questionable and should be eliminated. And of course, this is done in the context of the Wisconsin recount, where the only counties that are being recounted are Dane County and Milwaukee County. So ostensibly, any challenge that Trump's campaign is making is likely to a vote that didn't support him.
There has been some confusion, I think, over how the recount is working, especially since it's only Dane and Milwaukee County. And as you say, there's been questions about this indefinitely confined voters list. One of the things that you've debunked is this idea that clerks in Milwaukee and Dane County colluded to add 250,000 people to that voter list. I think before we get into that, we really need to explain what that list is, what that means. Can you describe what an indefinitely confined voter is?
Sure. So this stems from a section of state statute that is trying to make allowances for a circumstance like someone who's in a nursing home and they cannot physically get out to cast a vote, and maybe they don't have access to the technology to submit a photo ID online like everyone else might need to when asking for an absentee ballot. So this creates an exception where you do not need a photo ID if you declare that you are indefinitely confined. And the statute says due to illness or infirmity, and that you are basically disabled for some indefinite period of time. The crux of this, though, is that this is a decision and a category that is left to the voter to declare themselves. So it's not a determination that's made by a clerk. It's if the voter says they're indefinitely confined by statute, they need to be treated that way.
So this idea that, you know, clerks in Milwaukee and Dane County could have colluded to add that many people to the indefinitely confined voters list, does that really add up?
So this is ultimately a claim that we rated as false. So there's two things that are baked into this. This is a statement from State Representative Joe Sanfilippo. He's basically saying that clerks added people to this list and that they colluded in doing so. He runs into problems in both of those elements. So first off is the concept of clerks adding to the list. As we discussed, this is not a determination that's made by the clerk. If a voter says, I'm indefinitely confined, the clerk's only option is to write their name on the list and send them ballots accordingly. The clerk can ask them, you know, maybe a month or two later, as many have sent out a mailing saying, are you still indefinitely confined? And they can make sure that voters understand what that definition is, but that's not a distinction that's left to the clerk. So the implication here that clerks are building out this list in some way, all they're able to do is follow up on what the voters say. The second piece of it is the collusion, and you know, that's a pretty loaded word. We don't know exactly what the representative is referring to here. He did not return our phone calls and emails looking for clarification. But we do know that the Dane County clerk sent out a letter early in the pandemic saying, because there's a stay-at-home order, everyone can be indefinitely confined and we'll treat you accordingly. That was objected to by Republicans, went up to the state Supreme Court, and ultimately the state Supreme Court said, no, you can't call everyone that. So then we saw amended guidance from the Dane County clerk and others around the state kind of as a result. On the collusion front, we know that the Dane County clerk had sent out an email to all of the other county clerks in the state saying, FYI, here's what I have sent out to the folks in my area. But beyond that, we sure don't know of anything else that, you know, is nefarious or is illegal. This is basically clerks trying to interpret an admittedly fairly gray area of state law in an unprecedented era.
Yeah. Among the many different claims that are being made right now, one that seems to exist not just here in Wisconsin, but across the country, is the idea that there was a glitch in voting systems that caused votes to reverse. It seems like a lot of these are based around a specific system, the Dominion system. Of course, here in Wisconsin, the two areas that were doing the recount don't actually use that system, although other counties, municipalities in Wisconsin do use Dominion. Neither Dane nor Milwaukee do. Where does this idea that, you know, a glitch in the voting system caused votes to reverse from Joe Biden, where does that come from?
This is really kind of following the pattern that we've seen throughout these last few weeks of people misunderstanding what our vote data says, and attributing something shady to it instead of just saying, hey, I don't understand how this works. Maybe I should research it a little more closely. One of the claims we looked at in this vein was a claim that there was a glitch in Rock County that moved votes over from Trump to Biden. But what this actually was a couple minute glitch in the vote feed being distributed by the Associated Press. So we basically saw websites had an errant number where they flipped the two vote totals for a few minutes, and then they discovered the error. Again, human error happens. They do double checks. They noticed it happened, and they fixed it. In that case, there was nothing that had ever changed in terms of the actual count with the clerk's office. This was just an error in how the media reported those tallies. On the Old Dominion side, there was a legitimate glitch that happened, most notably in Antietam County in Michigan. But again, it was caught, it was corrected. And so we've kind of seen the Dominion name used as if this glitch in this location has somehow discredited this system nationally, and there's just no evidence of that.
When you look at some of these claims, especially the ones that really have no basis in reality, I think people can understand kind of where the misinformation about perhaps Dominion comes from, but some of the others are pretty outlandish. What's the hardest part of combating this misinformation with facts?
Well, the fact is there's just a large portion of the population that's really not interested in reviewing claims through a critical eye, in reviewing evidence kind of with an open mind. Fact-checking organizations like PolitiFact and many others, you know, we're including links to the data sources and the experts that we're using to say this really doesn't pass muster, this doesn't hold up to scrutiny, and people just aren't even making it far enough to review that evidence. It's simply, this is my candidate, this is my view of the world, this claim fits my view of the world, therefore I will believe it, I will share it, I will defend it, no matter what evidence is presented to me.
Eric Litke is a reporter with PolitiFact Wisconsin and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been covering many of the misconceptions about the election and the recount here in Wisconsin. He spoke with LakeFact's Joy Powers. Coming up next, a cancer survivor who biked across America shares her story in our Fit for You segment. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Elizabeth McGowan was only 15 years old when her father died of melanoma at the age of 44. When she was just out of college, McGowan was diagnosed with the same cancer that took her father. At first, she thought it was a death sentence, but at 39, McGowan reached the major milestone of being 5 years cancer-free after over a decade of treatments. To mark the occasion, she set out to bike over 4,000 miles solo across America from west to east coast. Her new book, Outpedaling the Big C, documents not only her cycling journey, but her experience dealing with her cancer, as well as her father's. McGowan joins me now for this month's Fit for You segment and starts by explaining the goal of her trip.
A huge part of this trip, I organized it actually as a fundraiser for the hospital in Waukesha, where I'd had a lot of my treatments for melanoma. So my pitch was, look, I want people to know that cancer is survivable. There is no fault in anybody who doesn't survive, but I wanted people to see living evidence that you can get through this and have a robust life on the other side. So that was my goal. And it was, outreach was key. So it made me interact with people.
You've done other physical adventures before, most notably the Appalachian Trail earlier in your life, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But with a biking trip across America, did you feel the need to do any extra prepping, either in your gear or training, before you embarked on this trip? Because at this point, you had a clean bill of health.
That's right. That's right. It was really this trip I organized to celebrate being 5 years cancer-free, right? And it would be, as one of my friends said, it would be very un-Elizabeth-like to have a party. So instead, I had to organize a trip, and I had wanted to ride my bike across the country. And I approached the hospital staff about helping me, you know, be the collector of the money, their foundation. And they said yes. So then I was on my way. So with backpacking and bike packing, I guess you can call it, there's a lot of overlap. So I had gear from hiking, which I could just sort of recycle for my bicycle, which was lovely. And my goal was I had two panniers and they went over my rear tire. And if they didn't fit in there, they didn't go on the trip because I did not want to carry a lot. I wanted this to be, I'm a minimalist and this trip just emphasized that. So the prep, one of the reasons I left in August is because the weather in Wisconsin, training is a little more difficult, right? So I was able to build up some stamina that spring of 2000. And then I launched the trip. Well, I had to drive out to Oregon, but doing that gave me a little bit more time to, I don't know that you can ever be totally prepared, but I felt prepared enough.
Well, it is intimidating as well. And, you know, this was obviously a celebration of a clean bill of health, but did you always have like a lingering concern for your health traveling through bike alone if something were to happen?
That was really the last thing that I worried about. I was more concerned about, I had put this out there, and this was kind of, you know, this was the early internet era, but I had vowed and promised a lot of people that I was going to do this ride. And it sounds great, but there were times when we were driving, my husband and I were driving out to Oregon because the trail starts in Astoria, which is on the Pacific Ocean. And some of the landscapes up and down, I thought, what am I doing? Why didn't I just tell people I would ride around the state of Wisconsin? Wouldn't that have been good enough? That was the daunting part because I thought, holy cow, I've got to deliver. So it was kind of a head game. The physical part, I thought, we'll see. So that was the daunting part.
Now, the structure of your book goes between your cycling journey and flashes back both to your own cancer treatments as well as your experience witnessing your father going through melanoma as well. You were diagnosed kind of around the same age he was. And it gives us real insight into the big scope of your journey and why you were on this bike. So why did you feel it was best to share your story this way in this structure?
Well, that took a long time. And, you know, as a reporter, we are trained to ask questions of other people and put them on the spot and have them respond and then synthesize that material. So I found it really difficult to ask myself, maybe not asking myself, the answering part was hard. And in doing this book, I did not want it to be a travelogue. I didn't want to say, oh, I saw this and I met this person and they invited me into their house and we, all of those lovely things that happened. But getting to the core, I either was going to write the book and make it really hard to do, or I was going to not write the book. So I came up with the idea of delving into my own cancer because sometimes I think I was making myself vulnerable and that was difficult, but I persisted with it. And, you know, when I was 15, my father was 44 and he died of melanoma. So the image that I carried around of melanoma was that if you got it, you died. And when you're 15, what do you know? I mean, I knew surface parts of my father. He was an undeveloped character. So part of the, like, I went through Yellowstone, I went through, and there were parts of Oregon, there were physical landmarks that I went through that reminded me of him because we had been a camping family growing up. So I thought, why can't I flesh out who he was and understand who he was? Because he was pretty volatile. You know, he'd served in the Korean War And I always wondered why he was so explosive. He could be so much fun, and then the next minute he'd turn explosive. And making myself delve into his life and understand, and the cancer link was very strong, and I appreciated who he was and what he was going through, so I could make sense of who this mysterious man was.
You say that your trip was also like psychotherapy, kind of what you're touching upon, and it reinforced a tenet that you had learned by watching your father at his best, which was maintaining a sense of humor, even under duress. So there are certainly lots of great humor moments in here, but I'm wondering, did you surprise yourself along the way or prove yourself wrong with any misconceptions you went in taking this trip?
I know I like to say that this is a sobering trip, but there's lots of joy and humor in it. And I think that one of the best surprises was how welcoming people were across the country to my message. I mean, I intentionally did not carry a cook stove, right? I was mostly carrying layers. And then, of course, I had this huge bundle of brochures. I had named my trip Heels on Wheels because it's easy to remember, it's short. And so the hospital helped me put those together. So I would hand those out. So that would make me stop and eat at restaurants. And any little town that I stopped in, I would make myself do a couple of outreach sessions. There were lots of little hospitals too, and I would go in and drop things off there, because once again, it was, you know, look at me and what I can do. And I'm not, you know, I don't have to be your personal beacon. I just wanted to spread the message that it was a hope message. And but the rewarding part was people, A, just listening to me, which was remarkable. And B, you know, inviting me for dinner, inviting me overnight, you know, letting me use their computer to do a journal entry, because I didn't have a laptop or anything with me. I was counting on libraries and community colleges to do these, because that was part of it. The hospital had this map and I was this little blue dot, right? And they would move me. I would send in a journal entry from somewhere. So this might answer another one of your questions, but people say, what do you think about all the time when you're on that bicycle for, you know, it's your job, your job is riding your bike. And a lot of me, you know, being a writer, I would keep a journal every night in a paper notebook. But when I got to a place where I had the liberty to do something digitally and send it back to the hospital, so I was organizing my thoughts so that when I sat down, I could spew something out that made reasonable sense. You know, it wasn't totally polished, but it was sort of, you know, the first draft of my history, so to speak.
Right. And on the note of the human connections you made along the way, you know, they were remarkable, and it showed a vulnerability between you and the people you met, right? And this I found to be in great contrast back to when your cancer returned. You were living in Wisconsin and it returned to your internal organs. And you at the time reflected that no one was ever supposed to know how you really felt, because that was exposing weakness, which you thought was wrong. So what a switch of that mindset.
That's right. Because once again, writing the book forced me to evaluate those things and speak those truths. So it would have been easier for me to say, well, oh no, I always thought that I should make myself vulnerable. But it was, you know, it's how you grow up. And I grew up in New England, and maybe there's something about, look, you just, you know, buck up and you move on and figure it out. Because, you know, back in the 70s when my father had died, the world didn't have therapy sessions and help. The message to us was, well, figure it out and carry on. So that's what we did. So I had to learn how to make myself more vulnerable and expose myself, so to speak, in the right way. And that was hard. And I wanted people to understand that, because I think a lot of people think that, oh, those traits come naturally to people. And I think sometimes it's an inside job and it's really hard work. But if you aspire to something, you have to work on it. And that's part of the message that it wasn't just getting through the cancer. It was also revisiting the messages that I carried around in my brain and how I wanted to reprogram myself, so to speak.
One thing you also reflect on is that you're motivated by doing actions instead of just hoping, and that you figured performing physical feats was like a vaccine for cancer. And you hiked the Appalachian Trail, and during that time, obviously, it wasn't this kind of project. It was for you, and you didn't have to keep journal entries to submit to a hospital, per se, but you had an uncomplicated sense of purpose on the trail and embraced the simplicity of hiking. So did your cycling trip make you feel the same way years after hiking the AT, or did you find it a different experience but ultimately the same, and doing something physical was healing in some way?
Yeah, and you had mentioned the psychotherapy before, and I think it's that act of movement that is, it's sort of like a metronome. So walking, I always found therapeutic. It's, you know, what do you do? Well, you put one foot in front of the other and you make progress, and having a goal was helpful. I mean, walking from Georgia to Maine, I mean, that was what, 2,100 something miles. So that was very liberating. But once again, I had gone through these hideous chemotherapy treatments and I was well. And I was also in my 20s. And I thought, well, I don't know how much time I have. I better do these things that maybe other people would put off till retirement. I've got to do things now. So that the cancer gave my life, I gave me a sense of urgency, I guess, when I was doing the trail. And doing the bike ride was, it's the same kind of thing. You know, it's that movement of that, of the bike, the pedals going around one rotation at a time. You're making this trip. You don't go across the country in one day. And my idea was, look, the life that I have right now is basically dessert, because I didn't think I'd last this long. So I just figured whatever it takes, I will do each day. And if I stop to, because I see something interesting and want to learn more about it, then that's what I do. It was about immersing myself in, and part of it is the natural world. I mean, that's important to me, and it still is part of my, you know, my ethos. So it all tied together.
You also say what liberated you was consciously deciding not to be a victim of the disease. I mean, going from seeing your father pass away, and I'm sure cancer treatments were very different when he was dealing with it compared to when you were dealing with it starting in your 20s, and even to how they've advanced to today.
Right. And I think that word just sets people up to feel just lesser than. And I know that there was a concerted effort probably in the 80s, the 90s, to get away from that word and move it. I mean, words matter, words are powerful, and to use the word survivor. And like I said, you know, cancer is, I mean, you can be fortunate in that you get the right treatment at the right time because you're living in the right place. There is no 100% guarantee on anything, but you do have to persist and you have to advocate for yourself. So I just figured whatever days I get, because when you get this in your 20s and you watch your father die, you think this must be a death sentence. I better maximize every day, which can be exhausting, by the way. So, but you learn to just appreciate things and take them in stride. I mean, you don't want to have this in your body. You want to get rid of it, whether it's through chemotherapy or surgery or whatever method they're using. But it was about putting one foot in front of the other and moving forward. That was crucial, because it's also a head game.
If you're comfortable sharing it, how is your health now? How are you doing?
Oh, my health is really good. I mean, obviously I'm older. I think about that bike ride and some of those daunting climbs that I did. I think the highest one was, you know, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000. It was high. But I still ride my bike. I'm still active. I swim. I stay in shape, because it's exercise to me is cheaper than visiting a therapist, right? And it keeps me whole. And I try to do it year round, because it's part of me. And if I don't do it, then people can tell, like, Elizabeth, you're a little bit grumpy. I know, I need to move. So
And have you been cancer-free as well?
Yes. Excellent. I mean, here's the thing about melanoma, right? It's insidious because it first showed up as a skin lesion, right? And that's the thing. You can see it. So you think, all right, I see it. Let's take care of that. The scary part is when it goes inside. And, you know, it was in my liver, it was in my lungs, it was in various places, which you'll learn about if you read the book. And that's what is terrifying when you first learn that and you think, uh-oh, now we have a different enemy. So that it's sort of like about democracy, it's eternal vigilance. So you have to go see the dermatologist, you have to use your sunscreen. And, you know, I'm on the bike ride, I was carrying, you know, sunscreen coupons to hand out to people. So that was another good entree to a conversation. You know, the 5-year mark of being cancer-free that I use to organize and carry out the bike ride, there are no guarantees, but it's a good marker. And thus I thought, this is a good time to do this. Now, you know, did I think I would last another whatever, how many years it's been? No, I didn't. I had no idea, but here I am. So I had to get this book out, right?
Well, and you note that every time you thought you wanted routine patterns, a sense of, quote, normalcy, you end up embarking on an adventure. So do you have a next one in mind?
Well, I tell you, you know, people keep asking me that. And one is getting the word out about this book, because I feel like it's really important to get this in the hands of people who, you know, whether they ride their bikes, whether they've survived cancer, everybody has a cancer story, right? And I want people to see what's possible. So that's why I wrote the book. The other part that I do is I do a lot of volunteer work in addition to my regular job, because the earth matters. And so I do a lot of invasives removal, which I was doing when I lived in Wisconsin. And that's sort of how I give back. I do trail maintenance on the equivalent of the Appalachian Trail. And so those kinds of things, I don't know that I need to do some dramatic overarching trip again, but this kind of ties the bow to what I was trying to do, is the natural world is a balm. And I feel like it still is, and it doesn't mean I have to be hiking. I mean, I still hike, I still do trips, but it's that giving back part now that I find very rewarding.
Well, Elizabeth McAllen, I want to thank you so much for not only sharing your book, but sharing your insights with us. It's greatly appreciated.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your interest. I very, very much appreciate it.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Elizabeth McAllen is a cancer survivor and the author of Outpedaling the Big C, My Healing Cycle Across America. She joined me for this month's Fit for You segment, and you can explore others at WUWM.com. Coming up next, astronomy contributor Gene Creighton joins us to talk about the future of private space travel. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. This month, 4 astronauts arrived at the International Space Station thanks to the SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket that launched from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. It was a milestone for both NASA and SpaceX as the Crew Dragon's first fully operational mission, and it marks its second crewed flight. The government and private agencies have been working together for about a decade to get more people into space. This recent accomplishment also makes us think about what's in store for the future of private space travel for the ISS and beyond. Astronomy contributor Jean Creighton joins me now, and she notes that while the SpaceX may seem shiny and new, it's just the latest in private companies working with the government.
It's true that people imagine that this is a brand new thing and maybe a departure from what NASA used to do. But perhaps it's useful to remind our audience that the Apollo missions required NASA to subcontract with 20,000 companies in order to make all the various parts that they required. And I guess one of the, I was reading around the 50th anniversary that perhaps the single most magnificent achievement of NASA was to coordinate that effort, to give companies the exact specifications of what they required, help them do the quality control inspection, and integrate all those different parts into a moving spacecraft. So this is definitely a continuation of a tradition that's been established for 60 years now, if not 70.
So why are private companies even interested in this? Are they often working on something that can be easily adapted to serve NASA's purposes? Or are they starting with the idea of space innovation and engineering in mind?
I think there's a little bit of both. Many of these companies treat NASA as a client, and NASA as a space agency has pretty deep pockets. So it makes sense to provide products that NASA can use. However, there's also this issue of clearly private companies are more interested in space travel now, and that's because a confluence of events has taken place that makes, at least potentially, space travel cheaper. So, for example, a big thing now is to be able to reuse in materials. So because it used to be you would launch, so you burn a tremendous amount of fuel, and as those stages, those pieces of the rocket that carry the fuel, they empty. Well, you don't carry dead weight with you, you drop it. And those pieces would fall into the ocean, they disintegrate, you know, whatever, but you can't recover them. And, you know, that was what we accepted had to be. However, now we've developed materials, composite materials, so not sheets of aluminum, that you can reuse because we have smart enough computers that you can tell, okay, you piece that are coming down, I want you to actually fall right here. So they can figure out, you've seen some of these landings, the pieces come back on a platform as if you ran the movie backward. It really is quite impressive. And the first time I saw that, I thought, oh, come on. How could it possibly be so precise? What we need to remember is that the Apollo missions were running on computers that are significantly, like, millions of times less powerful than the computer on your phone right now. Imagine if we really put a serious computer behind this, we can really do calculations and make things happen that simply weren't possible or even imaginable in the 60s. So on the one hand, we have the technology to rescue some of the pieces, which is great. The other thing is that we now can make materials that are much easier to manufacture. You can make huge pieces. They don't require the same amount of labor. So labor is one of the really expensive pieces of this, and you can eliminate a lot of it, which means in the end that you have launches that you can change the cost by an order of magnitude. And then it becomes almost, if you're rich enough, I mean, maybe you and I, Audrey, aren't going to go to the International Space Station, but if you have a couple hundred thousand dollars burning a hole in your pocket, it's possible to do that, to spend a few minutes in a weightlessness, or if you spend a little more, you could, in fact, get to the International Space Station under certain circumstances. So it's interesting to watch how this progression has taken place and how it's possible that it will continue in the future. Now, I don't think that deep space is going to be taken up by private companies.
Right. Do you think that, you know, you mentioned NASA has the big pockets. They've established a lot of the groundwork, so to speak, that has needed to be done in order to get to where we are today. And while deep space compared to low Earth orbit, those are two very different things. So do you think the privatization will remain in the low Earth orbit for the foreseeable future?
That would be my guess, because I think deep space not only requires know-how, you have to have thousands of scientists and engineers who are going to analyze the data that you collect, who are going to plan missions. This is not a, you know, a small budget operation. Oh, we'll have this little R&D little group of people, you know, half a dozen people do this. You really need a much larger, I want to say the word army, a much larger group of people who can stand behind you. So for now, I imagine that this is definitely going to still be on you know, on space agencies around the world. What I do imagine is that these things become more collaborative. That I can certainly see.
At one time, we thought a lot of this was the stuff of science fiction, but do you foresee things like private space stations in our future or a base on the moon?
Well, that's the plan, right? The plan is to get a base on the moon and a space station, if you will, around the moon. We'll see how this all is impacted by COVID. But if we want to get somebody to the moon, which is we're supposed to be wanting to do that in 2024, the goal is to get a human and the first woman on the moon by 2024. That's going to require, if we're going to do that for any period of time, for any length of time, it's going to be a lot easier to launch back and forth to the moon if we had a base around the moon. Now, this already starts a little, sounds a little bit like science fiction, but that's the plan. And if we have such a scheme established, then it's going to be a whole lot easier again to go to Mars, which is the hope for 2040. Now, every time an administration changes, things could change, priorities and such. So we'll have to see. But I know for a fact that, for example, a return mission to Mars is already being planned as we speak. It's already moving. That's scheduled for 2030. So we just have to wait and see. But all these partnerships, these successful missions, you know, build confidence that the current partnerships that NASA has with private companies might be as fruitful as prior ones.
So these two sectors can really complement each other, and it's not necessarily, you know, is there a wide misconception of privatization of space turns into, you know, letting development go unchecked, so to speak, but in space?
Well, it could. I mean, the fact of the matter is that private companies are sending hundreds of satellites that are very small, but they are disruptive to astronomers. And apparently nobody really thought about that as a problem. Now they're trying to, after the fact, they're trying to figure out how to minimize the effect so that it's not as detrimental. But it does remind us that really oversight is helpful. And people should be talking and figuring out how does what I do impact other parts of society.
So although the SpaceX launch, it was funded by government funds, but it's a big step forward. It's a big change. So what do you think is the next trial for private either jobs similar to SpaceX up to ISS or other contracts that are in the works?
I think the next best batch of, or the next sort of future batch of things is surrounding what I already described, that whole idea of getting people back to the moon and whether we're going to build a base, because that's the idea. It's called Gateway, a base around that. I assume that parts of that will be built by contractors, subcontractors for NASA. Any of that that can come together in a way that's innovative, opportunities to show to showcase some new technology, some new material, all of those things would be great for everyone involved.
When it comes to establishing a moon base, having more low orbit and deep space missions, we're beyond international regulations because we're not even on Earth, but yeah, who gets to call dibs or establish the first base on the moon and say it's NASA's base versus international partners? Is there any diplomacy already established in how we move forward in new things, not just for NASA in the United States, but international space exploration?
There are treaties and rules. You're right, of course, that when you change the game, you have to make sure that, you know, these are revisited and people agree. One of the difficulties with having governments that aren't always talking very nicely to each other is that these conversations sometimes get unfruitful, let's put them that way. but I think there certainly are some regulations in place that you can't just go around saying this is mine or what have you. But that's another issue with private companies, that they haven't signed such treaties. So I think these are good conversations. It's good to have people aware of policy that should be in place, that should be abided by everyone involved.
Well, very exciting steps for everyone, and we'll continue to see what develops in our future.
We sure will. And as always, I very much appreciate chatting with you, Audrey.
Lake Effect contributor Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium on the UW-Milwaukee campus. You can explore all of our astronomy segments with her at wuwm.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.